Judges chapter 13. Samson. I think Samson has a lesson for us. Here's a man that was under Nazirite vow of separation to God, and God gave him unusual power. Samson is characterized by outstanding miracles such that he's almost unique in the scriptures. As far as having supernatural physical strength, he goes down in history as, you know, the most outstanding man in the Bible in this regard. Other men have done miracles and used by God, but not the type of thing where you're bending steel and a real Hercules or a Superman. But the lesson is, he was under Nazirite vow, the power of God was on him, and he fell. That's the lesson. He lost his separation unto God. And I really believe that God has got us under Nazirite vow in some regards, and he's bringing us and purifying our vow until we're really in a vow of separation unto him. And he is going to pour out his power on us, and the devil's going to try to snare us and trip us up and cause us to be careless and lose our vow and then lose our power. And this is what the devil tries to do to every Christian, to every minister, every spirit-filled minister, every man whom God uses in a mighty way. Their life can be likened unto Samson's because the devil is trying to get them. Now we left off in chapter 13. Manoah offered up this offering. And verse 21, the angel of the Lord did no more appear to Manoah and to his wife. Manoah said unto his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God." His wife, thinking logically, more logically than he, "If the Lord were pleased to kill us, he would not have received a burnt offering and a meal offering at our hands. Neither would he have showed all these things." Well, how about that for logical thinking? You know, verse 22 is where a lot of Christians are at right now. They're thinking something totally absurd. "Well, I'm not going to make it." And the person next to you might go, "You're not going to make it. After God's done all these wonderful things for you, moved in your life, brought you to the chapel, brought you this far, and you're not going to make it." I mean, verse 23 is no divine revelation. It's just clear thinking is all. And verse 22 is ridiculous. And a lot of us are in verse 22. Thinking something that doesn't even add up to 4. 2 and 2 is 3. I told a brother one time the devil was lying to this brother. So bad. And I said, "Brother, the next time the devil lies to you like that, just tell him 2 and 2 is 4 and you won't believe anything else." And I said to him, I said, "If I came up to and told you that 2 and 2 is 3, would you believe me?" He said, "No." And I said, "Well, what do you believe in this nonsense for? It has about as much intelligence as that. Just tell him 2 and 2 is 4. Verse 23 is just simply 2 and 2 is 4. That's all. It's just common sense. In other words, God is moving. I'm in his will. I'm going to open up my heart to him and trust him and believe him and live a day at a time. People say, "How do you go through all those things?" I'll tell you how. A day at a time. One day at a time. In fact, there have been times where the next hour was a challenge. But you can make it through the next hour. And you make it through the next hour, it's one more hour for the Lord. You make it through that day, it's one more day for the Lord. And you've done what God wanted you to do. And you keep doing that, and day after day after day, and God's going to bring you out of that valley. He's going to bring you out in the sunshine. Pretty soon you're going to say, slow down, Lord. I want to enjoy each day. Before that, it was hurry up and get these days over with. You'll come out just one day at a time. You can make it through one day. Now, I know there's times when you don't think you can. But the Lord will be there. What we need is verse 23, common sense. Instead of verse 22, demonic thinking. Verse 24, the woman bare a son and called his name Samson. The child grew and the Lord blessed him. The Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp, began to agitate or thrust him. He began to have a zeal, agitation, divine energy in his soul. Now remember, Israel was oppressed of the Philistines. What did this agitation mean? I believe that Samson began to feel the burden of Israel. He began to be urged, motivated. He began to, like Moses, was grieved at his brethren. Moses had something in his heart that wanted to check on his brethren down there in the slime pits. Samson began to be urged upon by the Spirit. This just doesn't just mean nothing. The Spirit of the Lord began to move him. In what way? Move him in what way? Move him with the heart of God. Move him with the burden of the Spirit. Move him with the impact of the bondage of the nation. And he began to see. And he began to feel like, I want my people free. I want my brethren free. Now, Samson is the last judge after the seventh servitude. Samson does not lead an army. What he does single-handedly. Samson, I feel, typifies the church in the last days. As it were, the last moving of God's Spirit after the seventh servitude. The church has been up and down over the centuries, you know. And God has a man-child about to be born under Nazarite vow, who will be separated unto God under submission to him, whom God is going to endure with mighty power. And that man-child is going to be a target of demon spirits to knock them out of their position of holiness with the Lord. Because their separation unto God is going to be the thing that keeps demon spirits from being able to get them. And those spirits are going to work to try to get that man-child out. And many are going to fall. We know that in the scriptures. Many are going to fall. The man-child won't fall, but members of it will. Members of it will fall away. There'll be a great falling away. Samson is a target for the devil. Chapter 14. Well, we said at the beginning of chapter 13, when it says, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, that was the seventh time. Samson went down to Timnath, saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, this, God is using the type of man Samson is. You know, God will use you. He'll take advantage of your weaknesses, if you'll open up to him, and he'll take advantage of your strengths. God will use what he's got to work with. He came up and told his father and his mother and said, I have seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me to wife. Now, Samson had an eye for women. And there's no way we're going to be able to justify him all the way through. I mean, some have tried to justify this. Then in chapter 16, verse 1, he sees a harlot, and they got that out of there. They've made that an innkeeper. And but then he ends up in the lap of Delilah and eventually loses his light and everything else. You're no way you're going to dig him out of the whole pit. Now, there are a few things I will say. Number one, Delilah was not a harlot. The scripture doesn't say that she was, and there's no reason to think that she was. In fact, Delilah was probably an Israelite. Probably not a Philistine, probably an Israelite. And so Samson may not have necessarily been out of God's will in fellowshipping with her, although, you know, everybody talks about a Delilah, the lap of Delilah. As far as I know, the guy's a single man and she's a single woman, you know, they could fellowship. But it's obvious their fellowship went beyond that. As far as the harlot in chapter 16, we might be able to get him out of that a little bit. But let's face it, you're not going to be able to get Samson out of this whole mess. The guy had an eye for women, let's face it. Now, he saw a Philistine woman. This was contrary to the law. Now, I know the commentaries argue that the prohibition was against Canaanite women, but that doesn't apply to a Philistine woman. But I say the spirit of the law applies, and the Philistines were Israel's enemies. They were oppressed to the Philistines. Besides that, the three chief Philistine cities were ones Israel were supposed to have conquered and didn't conquer back in Joshua. And so, yes, the law does prohibit this marriage. In my opinion, it does. His father and his mother said unto him, Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren, among all thy people, that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised? Samson said unto his father, Get her for me, she pleaseth me well. Now they knew he was under Nazarite vow. They knew that God had a call in his life. They knew that God's spirit was on him and that he was going to be used to deliver Israel or begin to deliver Israel. And now he wants to marry a Philistine, one of their enemies, who is their chief oppressor at this time. And his father and mother knew this didn't bear witness with their heart. I mean, this just doesn't bear witness. And doesn't bear witness with mine either. His parents were upset, naturally so. Naturally so. I believe this was the devil's plan. That's what I believe. Now, we can see that God worked in this situation. The scriptures tell us God worked in this situation. Go ahead.
Are you saying that the Israelites were supposed to wipe out the Philistines
at this time? At this time, no, because they were too weak. In the book of Joshua, yes. I don't remember it.
Well, he came in the argument Samson might give that she was not a Canaanite and a Philistine. But then you're saying this is kind of downfield blocking, that there aren't supposed to be Philistine at this time?
No. It says in the book of Joshua that they failed to drive out Ashdod, Ekron, and one of those other cities as a cities listed of incomplete victory. Joshua lists certain cities that they failed to conquer. And those are the chief Philistine cities along the coast. And so, had Israel had complete victory, there would be no Philistines in the land. And there probably would have been no backsliding either, and there would be no Philistine oppressor. That's what the scriptures seem to say to me. Now, I can't remember what the pastor taught on that, and if I'm contradicting him, we'll have to harmonize it somehow, but I don't really think that I am. I don't think he backed up. There's no way I can justify Samson going after this Philistine woman and wanting her to wife. I just don't think he could justify it in a million years. Now, God is working in Samson's life. So is the devil. Well, where is the devil working? Right here. Right here. The devil has put this on him so that all of a sudden he feels like this is the woman he wants. Do you know that you need to not trust some of the emotions you have every now and then? I mean, just have the urge, just the urge to do this. I don't trust a lot of those urges. You know, I have urges every now and then to just feel like going and playing golf. Not even anything wrong with it. Not even anything wrong with it. But I sometimes wonder, why do I have the urge to go play golf all of a sudden? I mean, I don't have the time. I mean, I have the urge to go, but I don't have the time to go. I mean, what's going on? And I usually don't get around to it. Every now and then I do. But you have these different urges. Some people fall in love with a certain person. A lot of times it's great. But I wonder, do you think the devil would try to have you marry the wrong person and pressure you? Don't think it would be a good idea to go through the pre-engagement counseling and make sure that, you know, you were compatible and that there's not some major problems? Do you know that people have married the wrong person? Do you know that they're now admitting it in this move and telling the counselor, well, the reason we should get a divorce is we just married the wrong person, that's all. I mean, this is just, you know, we didn't really, and we didn't have pre-engagement counseling back then and all blah, 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 blah. Well, it's too late now. Too late now. Now you're going to have to believe God for a miracle that he's going to turn a dog into a cat. That's what you're going to have to believe. That's what you're going to have to believe. I really like the pastor's pre-engagement counseling. He says, if you want a dog, don't buy a cat. Now, there's a lot of wisdom in that statement. It applies to getting married. And a lot of people have bought a cat when they wanted a dog. It's because they fell in love with the person. They fell in love with the cat, but they really needed a dog because of the type of personality that they had. And counselors try to talk them out of it and try to get them to see that it's just going to be a difficult situation. You're going to be strained. And the emotion was so great, like Samson, they've got to have a Philistine woman. And it's a mistake. Don't trust your emotions all the time. Sometimes you need to trust a counselor. Don't, you know, marriage is for life, but the emotion you've got right now isn't. It isn't. Break it off, and a couple months later, the emotion lifts, and you look at it with a clear head, and you say, well, I'm glad I didn't marry that person. Plus that, when you find the other person that you should be finding, then you're really glad. Really glad. Samson had this intense desire, and get her for me to wife. His father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord, that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. For at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. How do I interpret verse 4? There's one way to interpret it is that God put the desire in him to marry a Philistine woman. I have always had trouble with that interpretation. I just have trouble with that interpretation. If that's interpretation that you want to take, well, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm legalistic or whatever. I just can't buy that. I have another interpretation. Is that God was using Samson's carnal desire, and God knew that he had a plan up the road to get his will done, even though Samson had a carnal desire for something that wasn't in his will. His father and his mother did not know that it was of the Lord. That is, God was going to be using this very thing to bring this about. Now, let's take a look at it. Let's take a look at this. Did God really want Samson to marry a Philistine woman so that it could be just a total bomb-out, basket-case marriage and get God's will done? To me, I have a hard time believing that God would have somebody do something that appears to break all the principles we know, and then the whole thing was just a can of worms from the beginning to end, and then that was God's way of getting something done. I think, boy, doesn't God have any more clever ways of getting deliverance than that? Having Samson go marry a Philistine and then have the marriage be a bomb out? Now, let's look at this marriage. Samson has a marriage feast, as they did in those days, customary. And during that time, they put forth a riddle. The Philistines came up to this woman and threatened her that they would burn her with fire if she didn't reveal the riddle. So she did. And Samson knew in verse 18, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you had not have found out my riddle. He knew he had been betrayed. And verse 19, his anger was kindled. He went up to his father's house. They had a marriage tiff over the riddle. Verse 20, they gave the wife to somebody else. Fine marriage. Chapter 15, verse 1, Samson was feeling the emotion of anger and betrayal had left him. And he was feeling the love back for his wife. So, you know, a dozen roses and a box of candy, and he was on his way. And he got down there, and they'd given his wife to somebody else. And so that caused him to set their wheat on fire. Then they came up because Samson had set their wheat on fire, and they burned her and her father's house with fire, and that was the end of her. Now, that's not what I call a marriage in God's will. This is one of your typical marriages where the people have eloped and not gone the way of the counselors. This isn't a marriage where God said, marry her. By the way, these marriages where God said, marry her, these are usually the ones the counselors say, don't. It's amazing these days. In fact, there are so many people who have gotten married for the wrong reasons that it now looks to me like most people got married for the wrong reasons. And God knows this. God knows this. And He knows He wants, and He has a plan for our marriages. And He knows that the foundation isn't even right. And so no wonder He's stripping them down to the foundation. And in some cases, the foundation's being stripped. And so God must have some kind of a miraculous thing up His sleeve. We've got to hold on to God. Well, I married for the wrong reasons, and now I'm bombed out over my connection, and I'm in love, and I just want to bag my marriage and get on with life with my connection. My friend, you have myopic faith. There are hundreds of people that have the same opinion across the congregation. I don't mean with that same amount of unbelief, but at least the easy way. That would be the easy way. And I would like to say that God's way is never the easy way. His way is always the hard way. And I know that God sees this situation, and He sees human beings that have gotten married for the wrong reasons, and now the whole thing's come out and exposed. And now they're really found somebody that they, now that you're the one I should have married. That's just because they're in this hyper-connection, and they're under a delusion of emotion, and all the demons are suppressed and everything else. It's not what you think it is. And my feeling is God knows this, and He's got a plan to resolve the whole thing. He's going to resolve the whole thing. He is really going to take all these disasters, He's going to put them all back together, and He's going to make glory out of ashes. And I think that we need to have faith. We need to believe that God has sent this move, not just to pull back the covers and expose all the creepy crawlies in our marriages and all the dissatisfaction, but He's also got a solution for all that. If He's going to expose all that, then He's got a solution. I was talking to one brother, and I said, well, how was your marriage before this move? And he says, it was the best marriage you ever imagined. He said it was as good as the best baling wire could hold together. And a lot of people have admitted that before the move, things were not in the seventh heaven. And in the process of getting out those termite-ridden boards all throughout their house, called their marriage, they've had to knock a few walls down to get at them. So things don't look that pretty. God's going to rebuild. I really believe it. I have faith. I have faith for the impossible. Why not? If you need a little miracle, you might as well believe for a big one. Once you're in the realm of a miracle, friend, you might as well go all the way. I mean, if you're going to pray in $1,000, you might as well pray in a billion. I mean, if it's down to that, now, I know God's not going to give you more than your need. He's going to meet your need. But if you really need a billion, don't pray for 1,000. Pray for a billion. Pray for what will meet your need no matter how big it is. And remember, the faith is of the grain of a mustard seed. Now, verse 4, it was of the Lord. That is, God was going to take advantage of Samson's carnal desire, basically give Samson what his desire was. If you really want that, all right, I'll give it to you. But I'm still going to work, and you're violating my principles, and it won't be turning out to be what you think. God will often give us our will, but He'll still work in it, and we reap what we sow. Samson reaped what he sowed. This doesn't look like the blessed honeymoon that you'd expect. The whole thing was a total disaster from day one. Verse 5. Then went Samson down, and his father and his mother, to Timnath. Came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion roared against him. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he rent him as he would have rent a kid. He tore that lion in half, or in pieces, with his bare hands. He had nothing in his hand. He told not his father or his mother what he had done. He went down and talked with the woman. She pleased Samson well. Now he tore a lion, a young lion, literally a lion of lions. It's a lion in the prime of age. It represents that roaring lion. And my friend, when the Spirit of the Lord is upon you, that roaring lion is as nothing. When the Spirit of the Lord is not upon you, that roaring lion is way more than you can handle, and he'll chew you up into pieces. How do we defeat the devil? Friend, in the Spirit. When the Spirit of the Lord is upon you, the demons are as nothing. You can rend them with your bare hands. That is, you don't need anything else. The Spirit of the Lord is sufficient. Now in Acts 1:8, you shall receive power when the Spirit comes upon you. And I believe we shall rend that roaring lion. The lion is the type of our enemies who roar against us when we're in the way. But when the Spirit of the Lord is upon us, they're defeated. When the Spirit of the Lord is not upon us, we're in trouble. This is why we need to be moving in the Spirit. We've got to be moving in the Spirit. Now Israel, when the Spirit of the Lord was upon them, they defeated their enemies. When the Spirit of the Lord wasn't on them and they were disobedient and out of God's will, then their enemies ruled over them. Verse 8. After a time, he returned to take her. He turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, there was a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass of the lion. Now, the Hebrew word for carcass there is skeleton. Bees don't habitate a bunch of rotten meat. But it wouldn't take long for that thing to be totally stripped. You know, the animals and bugs and so forth would strip those bones. And after a time, the bees, evidently in the rib cage or something like that, made a bee's nest, and then there was honey. He took thereof in his hands and went on eating. Came to his father and mother, and he gave them, and they did eat. He told them not that he had taken the honey out of the skeleton of the lion. So his father went down unto the woman, and Samson made there a feast, for so used the young men to do. Came to pass, when they saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. Samson said unto them, I will now put forth a riddle unto you. If you can certainly declare it me within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 sheets, or shirts, better translated shirts, and 30 change of garments. But if you cannot declare it me, then you shall give me 30 shirts and 30 change of garments. They said unto him, put forth thy riddle that we may hear it. Now among the ancients, riddles were real sport. There used to be a lot more thinking going on back in those centuries than there is today. Are you saying they were smarter in those days than we are today? In a sense, their brains were more exercised and they spent more time dialoguing, thinking, and interacting. Whereas today, we vegetate in front of a boob tube. We're smarter today in that we have more information to memorize and higher technology, but they may have been more capable thinkers in those days because they did exercises of their mind, and riddles were sport. And so the challenge of a riddle would almost always be accepted because it was sport. He said unto them, out of the eater came forth meat, out of the strong came forth sweetness. And they could not in 3 days expound the riddle. And who could? That's a roughie. I'm not sure I could expound the riddle. Came to pass in the 7th day, they said unto Samson's wife, entice thy husband that he may declare unto us the riddle, lest we burn thee in thy father's house with fire. Have ye called us to take what we have? Is it not so? Well, they were poor sports. Samson's wife wept before him and said, thou dost but hate me and lovest me not. Thou hast put forth a riddle unto the children of my people and hast not told it me. He said unto her, Behold, I have not told it my father nor my mother. Shall I tell it thee? She wept before him the 7 days while the feast lasted. Came to pass on the 7th day that he told her, because she lay sore upon him. She told the riddle of the children of her people. The men of the city said unto him on the 7th day before the sun went down, What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? He said unto them, Cheaters. Cheaters. The riddle, the lion is Satan. The honey is the sweetness that is the result of the defeat of Satan. This riddle is a mystery. It's like the gospel of Christ. What is the interpretation of the riddle? By the power of God, the lion is defeated. And from the victory over the lion, there is sweetness to all who partake thereof. The power of sin, the power of death, those belonging to Satan, when those are defeated, great sweetness replaces it. And no Philistine who represents an unsaved person can understand this riddle. However, if they do understand the riddle, they get a change of raiment. And they won't understand the riddle unless someone expound it to them who's in the know. That is, somebody that's a Christian in the gospel can expound the riddle to somebody else, but you can't figure it out of your own carnal mind. What is sweeter than honey? The word of God. And what is stronger than, what does it say here? Stronger than a lion. God's spirit upon his people. And there's the sweetness and the victory. Verse 19, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. He went down to Ascalon, another Philistine city, and slew 30 men of them and took their spoil and gave change of garments unto them which expounded the riddle. And his anger was kindled at his wife, and he went up to his father's house alone. He was upset at being betrayed. But Samson's wife was given to his companion, whom he had used as his friend. Well, they gave her to somebody else. Chapter 15. Came to pass within a while after, in the time of wheat harvest, that Samson visited his wife with a kid. He said, I will go into my wife into the chamber. But her father would not suffer him to go in. Her father said, I verily thought that thou hast utterly hated her. Therefore I gave her to thy companion. Is not her younger sister fairer than she? Take her, I pray thee, instead of her. Well, fine surprise. Some honeymoon. Some marriage. Verse 3. Samson said concerning them, Now shall I be more blameless than the Philistines, though I do them a displeasure. Samson went and caught 300 foxes, the Hebrews jackals. He took firebrands and turned tail to tail and put a firebrand in the midst between two tails. Well, he basically tied their tails together and tied a torch onto that. And so the jackals, obviously animals afraid of fire, ran from the fire and dragged the torch through the fields of the Philistines, setting them on fire. So he had 150 of these things racing up and down the fields. Now, to catch 300 jackals, you know this was some affair. And when he had set the brands on fire, he let them go into the standing corn of the Philistines and burnt up both the shocks and also the standing corn with the vineyards and olives. Then the Philistines said, Who hath done this? They answered, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he had taken his wife and given her to his companion. The Philistines came up and burnt her and her father with fire. Well, that's what she was afraid of back in verse 15. It happened anyway. Seek to save your life, you're going to lose it. Notice how the heathen how treacherous they are among their own. Don't make any league or covenants with demons. There's no security there. Samson said unto them, Though you have done this, yet will I be avenged of you, and after that I will cease. All right, they burned his wife with fire. That provoked him again for another attack of revenge. He smote them hip and thigh. Hip and thigh is the intensity of the slaughter. With a great slaughter. And he went down and dwelt in the top of the rock Etam. The Hebrew is in the cleft of the rock. Well, after his mistakes, he went and hid in Christ. He went and hid in the cleft of the rock. The Philistines went up and pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why are you come up against us?" They answered, "To bind Samson are we come up, to do to him as he had done unto us." You know, this is going to go back and forth until somebody's destroyed. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. That's because the devil's on one side. Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock Etam and said to Samson, "Knowest thou not that the demons are rulers over us? Why, what is this, you community chapelite, you man-child saint? What is this that thou hast done unto us? Why, you're stirring up the demons and creating a problem. Don't you know that we're content as they rule over us? Why are you ruffling the demons' feathers?" He said unto them, "As they did unto me, so have I done unto them." Well, that was their attitude. They came up to do unto him as he had done unto us. They said unto him, "It's not enough that the demons be rulers over us. We come down to bind thee also, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the demons." And Samson said unto them, "Swear unto me that you will not fall upon me yourselves." They spake unto him, saying, "No, but we'll bind thee fast and deliver thee into their hand. But surely we will not kill thee." They bound him with two new cords and brought him up from the rock. Now, this is where the church world is today. Any wonder why God can only begin to deliver Israel through Samson and not really deliver them? Here are 3,000 men of Judah, God's own people, going to bind God's anointed and deliver him up to the devil. That's where the church is today. Christians working against God's elect. Christians in the church working to undermine. They want those that are anointed to keep peace with the world. They don't want us disturbing the world system, communism, pornography, and all these other things. They want to remain in their bondage because of fear. They're content to be slaves. They're compromised. In fact, not only are they compromised, but they want to bind you. They want you to be bound. It's not enough that they're bound. They want to bind you. So we'll be bound like they are. Be prepared for this. They want to bind you. That is, they want to put you under demonic bondage and take away your freedom in the spirit. They don't like this dancing, this connecting, this freedom, this joy, this love. They want to take it all away. They got two new doctrines that'll take it away. They'll bind you with two new doctrines. New doctrines that deny the power of God and bind Samson up. Do you know that without the Spirit, the church is bound? It's one thing I like about the pastor. He says, "Well, we don't know where to draw the line. And God hasn't told us in every detail where to draw the line. And if we draw it too tight, we'll lose the Spirit. If we draw it too loose, we'll be in the flesh. Some of the time, we'll be in the flesh." Well, if we lose the Spirit, we've lost everything. So we can't do that. And if we have it a little bit too loose, we'll keep the Spirit and we'll just have some flesh and we can work on that. We can preach on that. And we'll preach holiness of heart. And so that's what's being done. But I appreciate the recognition that if we're so afraid of a little flesh that we lose the Spirit, we've lost everything. If you lose the Spirit, friend, you don't even have any reason to be anymore. You have lost everything. So we've got to keep the Spirit, even if it means keeping some of the flesh. If you teach too much on it, you put fear in people's hearts, and all the gifts of prophecy will all dry up. That's the truth. You preach too much on false prophecy, and everybody will get paranoid. Nobody will yield to the Spirit anymore. You won't get any more prophecies. It'd be better to get some prophecies and then occasionally have some false ones, or just out of men's heart as they think they're yielding to the Spirit. You can always teach on that. But if you've got nothing, you can't teach on anything. So you can't refine it. You got to have something to work with. So whenever you work with God, you're going to have the Spirit move, you're going to have some flesh with it. In every revival, it's been true. So you can shut down the revival and have nothing, or you can have the revival and have some excesses and fanaticism. And because there's... Well, why don't we just have just the Spirit? Brother, wouldn't that be nice? That is the goal. But I mean, what church are you talking about? There isn't any that's like that. Beware of new cords that are trying to bind you and take away your liberty. Verse 14. Notice this. Samson's own brethren delivering him up. Friend, if that happens to you, don't be shocked. Don't be shocked. Don't be shocked when the very people you're trying to deliver turn on you and deliver you up to the devil. Don't be shocked. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him. Notice, here are these 3,000 men of Judah bringing him down bound to the Philistines to deliver him up. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the cords that were upon his arms became as flax that was burnt with fire, and his bands loosed from off his hands. It's like, look out. He found a new jawbone of an ass. He didn't even have a sword. It doesn't matter. The jawbone of an ass is like Shamgar's ox goad. We taught there that the victory is not dependent on anything in this flesh, but God's Spirit alone. The jawbone of an ass, that's plenty. He put forth his hand and took it and slew 1,000 men therewith. Samson said, with the jawbone of an ass, heaps upon heaps, with the jaw of an ass have I slain 1,000 men. It came to pass when he had made an end of speaking that he cast away the jawbone out of his hand and called that place Ramoth Lehi, that is, the hill of the jawbone. Now, in verse 14, the enemy shouted. You know the enemy rejoices when we're bound. Oh, the enemy rejoices. They shout against you when they see you bound by fear, by laws, by circumstances, by legalism. They get you bound one way or another. But I want you to know, when the Spirit of the Lord comes, there is liberty. 2 Corinthians 3:17. The Spirit of God breaks the bonds. And it's going to break your bonds. I love Richard Frank's testimony. When the Spirit of the Lord comes on you, friend, you'll be free. That's what you need. Instead of struggling through the mire, what you need is a dose of God's Spirit. And so put yourself where God's Spirit can move. Now, he testified that you can't do it until God sovereignly moves. There's a truth to that. But there's also a truth to putting yourself by faith where God is sovereignly moving. Because I believe that a lot of it is in our domain. In other words, you can time after time after time by faith put yourself where God's Spirit is. If God's Spirit is moving mightily in the prayer room, park your bodie there and get under the glory. Get in your automobile and move yourself down on Thursday nights and enter in. Interact with the brethren. Interact with the Lord. By faith, stretch forth your hands. Move by faith. God honors faith. Oftentimes, by giving in to hopelessness, you take yourself out of a framework where God can even move at all. You've got to put yourself in a framework where God can move. So by faith, just trust and keep putting yourself there, because God's Spirit will follow. Do you know that if it rains, it's just a matter of being outdoors and you're about to get wet? Now, I know some people have umbrellas up. God will have to show you what your umbrella is and how to take it down. But when it rains, you will have to actually consciously resist the Spirit to not get any of it. And if you just yield and do nothing, you'll get drenched. God's rain is falling. He's no respecter of persons. So put yourself by faith into the victory slot and just move in it. Keep doing that. Keep breaking out in that. Keep exercising faith. Keep opening up to God. Zechariah 4:6. When the enemy comes in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord will raise up a standard against it. Samson represents the invisible church, the man-child. The visible church is going to try to bind the invisible church. Do you know there are going to be laws in this country to try to bind us? There may be laws to restrict our religious freedom, our opportunities to worship or to do various other Christian things that we feel we need. And all I know is that somehow or other God's Spirit's going to fall on us, and it's those bondages are going to drop off. They're just going to drop off. How is God going to bring that perfection? How is He going to get a bride without spot or wrinkle? His Spirit's going to fall. Brother, when the Spirit's on, you don't want anything else. You don't want anything else. You're not interested in anything else. You'll live, eat, and breathe the Spirit. It'll be so wonderful. He's just getting us ready for it. Ezekiel 37, there were dry bones. They were scattered all over the valley floor. Well, they came together, but there was a day when the Spirit of God breathed into them. And life came into those bones. You know, you learn by your experiences. I remember back when I first came to this church, I was bound. And I knew God, I knew all kinds of things. It's like, it seemed like I've always known. And I walked in here just on a quirk. Brother had been witnessing to me, got me into this church, and it was just the most total luck that I ever even walked in here. I mean, I'm not taking away from God drawing me here and working on me, and that's obvious, see? That's obvious. But from my standpoint on it, I couldn't see God's Spirit doing anything at any time, wasn't even interested in it, wasn't even looking for God, didn't even want God. If you'd have offered me truth on a platter, I wouldn't even have been interested in it. And somehow or other, by a quirk, I consented to come up and visit the little church in the Ferdin basement. Just a quirk. And in fact, I'd have been invited probably 50 times and said yes and no and maybe and never showed up. And all of a sudden, I just showed up and bang. That was it. God visited me. Just because I showed up. And it's like the light went on. Okay, the light was on. Then there was a matter of giving up the world. Now that the light was on, I knew exactly what I had to do. Nobody said a word to me. They didn't tell me what to do. They didn't tell me. Nobody led me in the plan of salvation. I walked out of that room totally converted in and out. And I mean, outwardly, that was to come. But I mean, in my heart, I knew exactly what was going to happen. So I'm driving home with Christian Erickson, who brought me up there. And I was the last person they ever thought would get saved. And I'm in deep meditation in the car, thinking about what this all is going to mean, why it's going to cost me everything. I can see it now. Why, I'm going to have to give up this and this and this and this. I'm going to have to totally change this. I mean, my whole life is totally contrary to God. Everything about it is contrary to God. And I'm driving home and Christian's saying, well, what'd you think? And I'm going, fine, fine. He goes, well, would you like to visit again? I go, sure, sure. In my mind, that was it. I mean, I was there. For permanence, forever. I mean, I'd known, I met God. That was it. There wasn't any question about it. And he had no idea where I was at. If he would have asked me if I wanted to repent, pray, stand in my head, speak in tongues, I would have said yes to anything. That was it. He didn't even know where I was. He thought, well, maybe something did happen here. You know, I consented to come back. I would have consented to anything. So I met God when I came. And the light was on. My mind was under the light, and has been ever since. But the world had a grip on me. And I knew I had to come to Bible college. I knew I had to leave PLU where I was at. I knew if I didn't leave PLU, I would lose everything God had given me. I was clear as a bell. I didn't need anybody to tell me a thing. It's like it was there. It was all that information came into me in 1 second. But I couldn't get rid of it, the world. I could not get rid of it. I had the easiest, most fleshly lifestyle of anybody could ever have. I had everything going for me in the world. Everything. My whole life was totally nothing but a gravy shot. And I had everything that you could have in the world. I did. The world was in me and around me and over me. I had everything, you know, and I mean, I had the easiest life. And I had to give that up and go into the monastery for God. I mean, it just was not, it was not appealing. And I knew I had to do it. And I couldn't do it. And so then they started telling me, you need to come to Bible college. And I go, I know, I know. And I couldn't make the decision. It was like I was so bound, and I was bound to go back to PLU, and the money was already paid, and the schedule was already in. It's like everything was against me. And it's like, and I came to every service, but I knew I didn't have it within me to break the demonic hold on my life. I didn't even know it was demons or anything. I knew that I belonged here. And I knew that my whole flesh and being was going here, and I could not get out of it. And I knew I was going back, and it made me sad. And I thought, this is really a shame. You found the truth. You found the Lord. It's totally marvelous. It's better than anything could ever be. And you're so, and you just aren't, you're going to walk away from it and leave it. And I knew I was, and I knew I was going back to the world, as it were, and I was going to leave it all. And I knew that's where I was at. Okay, then in August, about 2 weeks before school started, on a routine Sunday service, the Spirit of the Lord fell on me right in the middle of the song service. Bang. Totally out of the blue. I was not expecting it. In fact, my parents were at the service. Of all the hindrances to be there. The Spirit of the Lord came like a lightning bolt upon me, just like on Samson in verse 14. And my bands were loosed on me. I could not even remember what was holding me back. I was so far from those things in the world, there was not one thing in the world that even appealed to me. Not one. And before that, everything was like, it was my whole life. It was all gone. Everything. All the things of the world, all the things that people get hooked on in the world, they flew away, and I thought, did I really like those things? Surely I couldn't have really liked those things. It's like, when the Spirit of the Lord comes on you, it's like this world becomes like an old dried up leaf. And I learned a lesson from that. I learned I don't need to struggle with sin. What I need to do is have the Spirit of the Lord come upon me. So I've always pressed for the Spirit. Press for the Lord. Press for the Spirit. Because I know when the Spirit of the Lord comes upon me, I won't want to have anything to do with anything that's outside of God. So I'm not going to lay in the bottom of the valley and wrestle with some demon of unwillingness. I'm going to get God's Spirit. I'm just going to go to God's Spirit. Because I can in God's legal righteousness that He's given me in Christ. I can always go in God's Spirit. It doesn't matter what sin's on me. It doesn't matter where I'm at. I can always get God's Spirit. I know that. And as I've gotten God's Spirit, and the Spirit of the Lord's been on me, and I felt His love, you can make any decision in the world. You can climb any mountain. It's like you'd be willing to do anything. I've always found willingness in God's Spirit. When I'm in God's Spirit, I've always been willing to do anything for the Lord. You know you've had those times. You know when God's Spirit on you, you do anything. You know, when God's Spirit's off you and the devil's on you, you're unwilling to do anything, hardly. I mean, you know, you're bound by one thing or another. That's how I've always gotten free in verse 14. It's always worked, and I've always been able to get free of everything. I got free of the whole world in one-hour experience as I sobbed through that song service, and I was totally free, just like that. Total divine action from heaven. And all I did was pray about it, and continue to come to services and put myself in a place where that could happen. But I didn't know what it was. I didn't even know that that was possible. God moved me into some realm in His Spirit that I didn't even know existed because I was so naive. All I could see was all the bondages and all the world. It's like a person who isn't willing to give up this world for the Lord, and God takes you on a tour of heaven for 3 days. When you get back to this place, it's like, all of a sudden you go, I actually like this place. This was actually a big deal to me. See, what you need are spiritual experiences. When you get spiritual experiences, it's like the things in your life that are holding on to you, it's like you don't want them anymore. They lose their technicolor. All of a sudden, they're black and white, gray, drab. And that's the way it was.